Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Zadie Smith, author of the critically acclaimed On Beauty, published by Penguin. In the weeks to come, we have Audrey Niffenegger, Nicholas Evans, Dan Savage, Clive Barker, Charles Blackstone, Lemony Snicket, Al Franken, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, thank you for coming this evening. It is my pleasure to welcome Zadie Smith once again to the Tattered Cover. Ms. Smith was last here for her debut novel, White Teeth, a book that was received with rave reviews from critics and readers, not only from her home turf in the UK, but also in the US and beyond. This was followed by The Autograph Man, and now by her new novel, On Beauty. While both her previous books were set in London, her new novel takes place in New England, mostly. A place familiar to Ms. Smith, as she taught for a year at Harvard. And academia, always a rich subject, is a world in which her characters live and work. The story centers around Howard Belsey, a white liberal art history lecturer, his African-American wife, Kiki, and their three children. His rival and enemy in the academic world is the black British scholar, Sir Monty Kipps, who accepts a position at the same university where Howard teaches. Well, as you can imagine, this is a heady stew, and Miss Smith has a great deal of fun exploring the possibilities it offers. She acknowledges her debt to E.M. Forster and his novel Howard's End, but she gives his exploration of class an update to the 21st century and her own witty spin to the characters she uses. On Beauty is a novel full of humor and honesty and is one that honors its model. Please join me in welcoming Zadie Smith.
Thank you. Thanks very much. That's a lovely introduction. I'm very heavily caffeinated because I've been touring for a long time and also very heavily made up to try and disguise the exhaustion. But I am going to read from kind of near the beginning of the book, and I don't know if you've read it or how far you are, so I'm going to explain a little bit. As was just said, it's about this man, Howard Belsey, and his family. And he has three children, Jerome, who's the oldest, Zora's the middle child, and Levi's the youngest at 16. And they live in Massachusetts. And kicks the book off is that Jerome has fallen in love with the daughter of Howard's worst enemy. And now Howard's worst enemy and their family have moved into town. And so to make peace, Jerome has decided to take his family on a trip to see a Mozart concert, which is the kind of thing that Jerome thinks will make peace for his family, though they don't always agree. The other thing you need to know is that there's lots of different accents used, and I can't always replicate them correctly, and some of them might be your own accent, which is even worse. And there's also a Nigerian accent, which is pretty abysmal. So you just have to, I'm no actress, so you have to bear with me on that stuff. Okay, here we go. Nobody much wanted to go to a concert, but it was impossible to deter Jerome when he was resolved upon a good deed. So here they were, a protesting silence filling the car, against Mozart, against outings generally, against having to take a taxi, against the hour's drive from Wellington into Boston, against the very concept of quality time. Only Kiki supported it. She believed she understood her son's motivation. The word on the college grapevine was that Monty was bringing his family, which meant the girl was coming. Jerome must behave as if nothing had happened. They must all do that. They must be united and strong. She struggled forward now and reached over Jerome's shoulder to turn the radio up. but it wasn't loud enough somehow to drown out the collective sulk. She stayed in this position for a minute and squeezed her son's hand. "Howie," she said, "you got any money? I can't find my wallet. I don't know where it is." They stopped at the top corner of the park. "Thank God, man. I thought I was going to be sick," said Levi, yanking open the sliding door. "Plenty of time for that yet," said Howard cheerily. "You might enjoy it," suggested Jerome. "Of course we're going to enjoy it, baby. That's why we came," murmured Kiki. Finding her wallet, she paid the driver through the window. "We'll enjoy it fine. I don't know what's wrong with your father. I don't know why he suddenly acts like he hates Mozart. I never heard that one before." "Nothing's wrong," said Howard, linking arms with his daughter as they began to walk the pretty avenue. "If I had my way, we'd do this every night. I don't think enough people listen to Mozart. As we speak, his legacy is dying, and if we don't listen to him, what will happen to him? Save it, Howard." But Howard continued, "Poor bastard needs all the support he can get, as far as I'm concerned. One of the great unappreciated composers of the last millennium. Jerome, ignore him, honey. Levi'll like it, we'll all like it. We're not animals, we can sit for half an hour like respectable folk." "It's more like an hour, Mom," said Jerome. "Who likes it, me?" asked Levi urgently. The mention of his own name was never an occasion for irony or humour for Levi, and like his own avid lawyer, he took a personal interest in every mention or misuse of it. "I don't even know who he is. Mozart? He got a wig, right? Classical," he said, with finality, having satisfied himself he diagnosed the correct disease. "That's right," agreed Howard. "Wore a wig. Classical. They made a film about him." "I seen that. That film eats my ass." "Quite," said Howard. Kiki began to giggle. Now Howard let go of Zora and held his wife instead, gripping her from behind. His arms could not go entirely around her, but still they walked in this manner down the small hill towards the gates of the park. This was one of the little ways in which he said sorry. They were meant to add up each day. "Oh, look at this line," said Jerome glumly, for he'd wanted the evening to be perfect. "I guess we should have left earlier." Kiki rearranged her purple silk around her shoulders. "Ah, it's not that long, baby. At least it's not cold." "I could jump that fence like that," said Levi, pulling at the vertical iron rods as they walked beside them. "You wait in line, you're a fool, seriously. A brother don't need a gate. He jumps the fence. That's street." "Again, please," said Howard. "Street," said Zora. "It's like being street, knowing the street. In Levi's sad little world, if you're a Negro, you have some kind of mysterious holy communion with sidewalks and corners." "Ah, shut up," said Levi. "You don't know what the street looks like. You ain't never been there." "What's this?" said Zora, pointing to the ground. "Marshmallow?" "Please, this ain't America. You think this is America? This is Toy Town. I was born in this country, unlike you. Trust me. You go into Roxbury, you go into the Bronx, you see America. That street." "Levi, you don't live in Roxbury," explained Zora slowly. "You live in Wellington. You go to Arundel. You've got your name ironed in your underwear." "I wonder if I'm street," mused Howard. "I'm still healthy. Got hair, testicles, eyes, etc. Got great testicles. It's true I'm above subnormal intelligence, but then again, I am full of verve and spunk." "No." "Dad," said Zora, "please don't say spunk, ever." "Why can't I be street?" "No, I always got to make everything be a joke. I just want to be street. Mom, tell him to stop, man." "I can be a brother, check it out," said Howard, and proceeded to make a series of hand gestures and poses. Kiki squealed and covered her eyes. "Mom, I'm going home, I swear to God. If he does that for one more second, I swear to God." Levi was trying desperately to get his hoodie to cover the side of his vision in which Howard was persisting. It was surely only seconds before Howard recited the only piece of rap he could ever remember, a single line he'd mysteriously retained from the massive lyrics he heard Levi mutter day after day. "I got the leanest, meanest penis," began Howard, and screams of consternation rose up from the rest of his family. "You never seen such a piece of genius. That's it, I'm gone." Levi jogged ahead of them all and tucked himself into the swarm going through the gates of the park. They all laughed, even Jerome, and it did Kiki good to see him laugh. Howard had always been funny. Even when they first met, she thought of him covetously as the kind of father who'd be able to make his children laugh. Now she tweaked his elbow affectionately. "Something I said," said Howard, satisfied. As they filed in behind the slow-moving crowd, the park gave off its scent for the Belsies, sap-filled and sweet, heavy with the last of a dying summer. On a humid September night like this, the Common was no longer that neat, historic space renowned for its speeches and hangings. It shrugged off its human gardeners and tended once more towards the wild, the natural. And the Boston primness Howard associated with these kind of events couldn't quite survive the mass of hot bodies and the crepitations of the crickets, the soft damp bark of the trees and the atonal tuning of instruments, and all this was to the good. Yellow lanterns, the colour of rapeseed, hung in the branches of the trees. The orchestra itself sat on a small stage on the other side of the pond. It was clear to Howard, the only non-myopic member of his family, that every male musician was wearing a tie with a musical note design upon it. And the women had this same motif printed on a cummerbund-like sash they wore around their waists. From an enormous banner behind the orchestra, a profile of Mozart's miserable, pouchy hamster face loomed out at him. "Where's the choir?" asked Kiki, looking about her. "Oh, they're underwater. They come up in like us," said Howard, miming a man emerging with a flourish from the sea. "It's Mozart in ponds, like Mozart on ice. Fewer fatalities." Kiki laughed lightly, but then her face changed, and she held him tightly by his wrist. Howard," she said wearily, looking across the park, "you want good news or bad news?" "Hmm?" said Howard, turning round and finding both kinds of news were approaching from across the green and waving at him. Erskine Jegedy and Jack French, the Dean of the Humanities Faculty. Jack French on his long playboy legs in their New England slacks. How old was this man? The question had always troubled Howard. Jack French could be 52. He could just as easily be 79. You couldn't ask him, and if you didn't ask him, you'd never know. It was a movie idol face Jack had, cut glass architecture, angled like a Wyndham Lewis portrait. His sentimental eyebrows made the shape of two sides of a steeple, always gently perplexed. He had skin like the kind of dark aged leather you find in those fellows they dig out after 900 years from a peat bog. A thin yet complete covering of grey silk hair hid his skull from Howard's imputation of extreme old age, and was cut no differently than it would have been when the man was 22, balanced on the lip of a white boat looking out at Nantucket through one sun-shading hand, wondering if that was Dolly stood square on the pier with two highballs in her hand. A compare and contrast with Erskine, his shining, hairless pate, and those storybook freckles that induced in Howard an unreasonable feeling of joy. Erskine was dressed this evening in a three-piece suit of the yellowest of yellows, the curves of his bumptious body naturally resisting all three pieces. On his small feet he wore a pair of pointed, Cuban-heeled shoes, and the effect was of a bull doing his initial two-step dance towards you. Still 10 yards away, Howard had a chance to switch his position with his wife, quickly and unobserved, so that Erskine would naturally veer towards Howard and French would go the other way. He took this opportunity. "Bell sees en masse," said Jack French, very slowly. "Missing one, I believe. Bell sees minus one. Oh, that's Levi, our youngest. We lost him. He lost us. To be honest, he's trying to lose us," said Kiki, and laughed. And Jerome laughed, and Zora laughed, and so did Howard and Erskine. And after all of them, very slowly, with infinite slowness, Jack French began to laugh. "My children," began Jack. "Yes," said Howard. "Spend most of their time," said Jack. "Yes, yes," said Howard, encouragingly. "Contriving," said Jack. "Ha," said Howard, "yes. To lose me at public events," said Jack, finally. "Right," said Howard, exhausted already. "Right, it's always the way." "We are anathema to our own children," said Erskine merrily, with a scale-jumping accent from high to low and back again. "We are liked only by other people's children. Your children, Howard, for example, like me so much more than they like you." "It's true, man. I'd move in with you if I could," said Jerome. "You'll come home with me then," said Erskine. "It's settled." "Please, take the rest too. Don't dangle carrots," said Howard, stepping forward and giving his friend a jovial slap on the back. He then turned to Jack French and put out his hand, which French, who turned to gaze upon the musicians, didn't notice. "It's wonderful, isn't it?" said Kiki. "We're so glad to bump into you two. Is Maisie here, Jack, or the kids?" "It is wonderful," confirmed Jack, putting his hands on his slim hips. Zora was elbowing her father in his midsection. "Jack," tried Howard, "you've met Zora, haven't you, my daughter? She's a sophomore now." "It is an unusual visitation of wonder," said Jack, turning back to them all. "Yes," said Howard. "For such a prosaic and," expanded Jack. "Hmm," said Howard. "Municipal setting," said Jack. and beamed at Zora. "Dean French," said Zora, picking up Jack's hand and shaking it for him. "I'm so excited about this year. It's an incredible lineup you've got this year. I was in the Greenman. I work on Tuesdays in the Greenman in the Slavic section. I was looking at the past faculty reports for like the past 5 years, and every year since you've been dean, we just keep on getting more and more amazing lecturers and speakers and research fellows. Myself and my friends, we're just really psyched about this semester. And of course, Dad's giving his incredible art theory class, which I'm so taking this year. I'm so over whatever anybody has to say about that. I mean, in the end, you've just got to take the class that will most develop you as a human being at whatever cost. I truly believe that. So I just want to say it's really exciting for me to feel Wellington's moving through this new progressive stage. I think the college is moving in a positive direction, which it needed, I think, after that dismal power struggle in the mid to late 80s, which I think really dented morale around here." Howard didn't know which piece of this horrible little speech the dean was capable of extracting from the rest, of processing or replying to, nor had he any idea how long this might take. But Kiki once again came to his rescue. "Honey, let's not talk shop tonight, okay? It's not polite. We got all semester for that, haven't we? Oh, and before I forget, God, it's our wedding anniversary in a week and a half. We're going to have like a shindig, nothing much, some Marvin Gaye, some soul food, you know, very mellow." Jack asked the date, and Kiki told him. Jack's face gave into that tiny, involuntary shudder with which Kiki had in recent years become familiar. "But of course it's your actual anniversary, so," said Jack, meaning to have said that to himself. "Yeah, and since by the 15th everybody's crazy busy anyway, we thought we might as well have it on the actual day, and opportunity for everybody to say hello, meet the new faces before semester begins, etc. Although your own faces," said Jack, "of course will not be so new to each other, will they? Is it 25 years? "Honey," said Kiki, laying her big hand on Jack's shoulder, "confidentially it's 30. Some emotion came into Kiki's voice as she said this. "Now, in the proverbial way of things," considered Jack, "would that be silver, or is it gold?" "Sadamantine chains," joked Howard, pulled his wife to him, and kissed her wetly on her cheek. Kiki laughed deeply, shaking everything on her. "But you'll come?" asked Kiki. "It will be a great," began Jack, but just then came the divine intervention of a voice over a tannoy system, asking people to take their seats. Well, Mozart's Requiem begins with you walking towards a huge pit. The pit's on the other side of a precipice which you cannot see over until you're right at its edge. Your death is awaiting you in that pit. You don't know what it looks like or sounds like or smells like. You don't know whether it will be good or bad. You just walk towards it. Your will is a clarinet, and your footsteps are attended by all the violins. And the closer you get to the pit, the more you begin to have the sense that what awaits you there will be terrifying. Yet you experience this terror as a kind of blessing, as a gift. Your long walk would have had no meaning were it not for this pit at the end of it. You peer over. A burst of ethereal noise crashes over you. In the pit is a great choir, like the one you joined for 2 months in Wellington, in which you were the only black woman. The choir is the heavenly host, and simultaneously the devil's army. It's also every person who's changed you during your time on this earth, your many lovers, your family, your enemies, the nameless, faceless woman who slept with your husband, the man you thought you were going to marry, and the man you did. The job of the choir is judgment. The men sing first, and their judgment is very severe. And when the women join in, there's no respite. The debate only grows louder and sterner. For it is a debate. You realize that now. The judgment is not yet decided. And it's surprising how dramatic the fight for your measly soul turns out to be. Also surprising are the mermaids and the apes that persist on dancing round each other and sliding down a staircase during the Kyrie, which, according to the programme notes, features no such action, even in the metaphorical sense. Kyrie eleison, Christi eleison, Kyrie eleison. That's all that happens in the Kyrie. No apes, just Greek. But for Kiki it was apes and mermaids all the same. The experience of listening to an hour's music you barely know in a dead language you don't understand is a strange falling and rising experience. For minutes at a time, you're walking deep into it, you seem to understand. Then, without knowing how or when exactly, you discover you've wandered away, bored or tired from the effort, and now you're nowhere near the music. You refer to the program notes. The notes reveal that the past 15 minutes of wrangling over your soul has been merely the repetition of a single, inconsequential line. Somewhere around the Confutatis, Kiki's careful tracing of the live music with the literal program broke down. She didn't know where she was now. In the Lacrimosa or miles ahead? Stuck in the middle or nearing the end? She turned to ask Howard, but he was asleep. A glimpse to her right revealed Zora concentrating on her Walkman, through which a recording of the voice of a Professor N.R.A. Gould carefully guided her through each movement. Poor Zora. She lived through footnotes. It was the same in Paris. So intent was she upon reading the guidebook to Sacré-Cœur that she walked directly into an altar, cutting her forehead open. Kiki tipped her head back on her deck chair, tried to let go of her curious anxiety. The moon was massive overhead and mottled like the skin of old white people. Or maybe it was that Kiki noted many older white people with their faces turned up towards the moon, their heads resting on the back of their deck chairs, their hands dancing gently in their lap in a way that suggested enviable musical knowledge. Yet surely no one among these white people could be more musical than Jerome, who Kiki now noticed was crying. She opened her mouth with surprise and then, fearful of breaking some spell, closed it again. The tears were silent and plentiful. Kiki felt moved, and then another feeling interceded, pride. "I don't understand," she thought, "but he does. A young black man of intelligence and sensibility, and I've raised him. After all, how many other young black men would even come to an event like this? I bet there isn't one in this entire crowd," thought Kiki, and then checked and was mildly annoyed to find that indeed there was one, a tall young man with an elegant neck sitting next to her daughter. Undeterred, Kiki continued her imaginary speech to that imaginary guild of black American mothers. "And there's no big secret, not at all. You just need to have faith, I guess. And you need to counter the dismal self-image black men receive as their birthright from America. That's essential. And, I don't know, get involved in after-school activities, have books around the house. And sure, have a little money, have a house without door." And Kiki abandoned her reverie for a moment to tug at Zora's sleeve and point out the marvel of Jerome, as if these tears were rolling down the cheek of a stone Madonna. Zora glanced over, shrugged, returned to Professor Gould. Kiki returned her own gaze to the moon. So much more lovely than the sun, and you can look at it without fear of harm. A few minutes later, she was preparing to make that final, concentrated effort to match the sung words with the text on the page, when suddenly it was over. She was so surprised she came late to the clapping, although not as late as Howard, whom it had only just awoken. "That it, then," he said, springing from his chair. "Everyone been touched by the Christian sublime? Can we go now?" "We have to find Levi. We can't go without him. Should try the cell. I don't know if it's on." Kiki looked up at her husband curiously. "What, so you hated it? How can you hate it?" "Levi's over there," said Jerome, waving towards a tree 100 yards away. "Hey, Levi." "Well, I thought it was amazing," pressed Kiki. "It's obviously the work of a genius." But Howard groaned. "Oh, Howard, come on, you have to be a genius to write music like that." "Music like what?" said Howard. "Define genius." Kiki ignored the request. "I think the kids were quite moved," she said, squeezing Jerome's arm lightly but saying no more. She wouldn't expose him to his father's ridicule. "And I was very moved. I don't see how it's possible not to be moved by music like that. You're serious? You didn't like it?" "I liked it fine. It was fine. I just prefer music which isn't trying to fake me into some metaphysical idea by the back door." "I don't know what you're talking about. It's like it's God's music or something." "I rest my case," said Howard, and now turned from her and waved at Levi, who was stuck in the crowd, waving back at them. "Thank you." "Thanks." "Thank you." "Thank you." Does anyone have any questions? Not on the text, obviously, just general questions. It's still going. I think it's going to take a long time, because I think when you write stuff which is not academic but is to be read by academics, I guess you have to be pretty sure that you're not talking out of your arse, quite obviously. It's something that I'm nervous about, and I'd like to spend quite a long time on it, so I don't think it'll be a few years before I'm finished. I think fiction's, you know, you don't have to be right about anything. It's much easier in comparison. I don't think my book has any effect on the larger population and appreciating different cultures. I mean, I don't know. I try not to think so generally, I guess, and that's kind of why I write, because I like to be specific, and I don't think about things in a kind of state of the nation fashion. I know the way that I relate to difference and the people I know relate to difference, but you can just change state or change country and everything's very different. So I don't know, actually. I don't know how to answer that. That's too enormous a question. I have to give up. Sorry. I really enjoyed it. One of my students is in the audience, so I have to emphasize my enormous enjoyment of teaching him and teaching in general. I taught a creative writing class and I taught a second class, which was kind of a theory class. It was combined, we were talking about various 20th century novels, and we were also talking sometimes about moral philosophers and ideas outside the text itself. And it was very enjoyable. I mean, I think, I don't know what Trevor would say, poor Trevor. He has to represent the entire experience. But I don't think I was a very good teacher in the beginning. I was very formal. I was taught very formally myself, so I couldn't get used to the idea that Trevor and people like him wanted to call me Sadie, for instance. I found that very disturbing. I think when I first started, I met some of my students again in Boston about a week ago, and they were saying that when I first started, I dressed like a teacher. I was so preoccupied with the fact I wasn't really a teacher. I had lots of teacher outfits and glasses and all the rest of it. But towards the end, I think we had a good time, didn't we, Trevor? It was fun. Yeah, I don't know if anybody learned anything, but we had a good time. And we had a lot of funny conversations, and I really enjoyed it. I'd love to do it again. It was brilliant. The same as most people. I guess my husband. I don't know. I watched 40-Year-Old Virgin about 4 days ago. That brought me a lot of joy. Maybe just because I'm on tour. But, you know, funny things and food. I like food a lot. The purest joy, I guess I like old musicals very much. And if I'm watching an old film, or if I'm watching Singing in the Rain or Meet Me in St. Louis, I'm pretty happy. Yeah. Apart from, everything in America is less formal, but that's the nature of the country, so that kind of filters down into the university. Right, the one big difference, but everybody talks about it, is that the kids are very demanding in America, and they consider it a service that you're giving them, and if you don't give it properly, they just, like, sue you or something, or get you fired. When I was in England, it's a very different... You come, like, you know, cap in hand, and you're so pleased to be taught, and you feel very, you know, blessed to be taught by these geniuses, all the rest of it. And in American university, I think the kids are much more... It's much more of a consumer culture. If you're not pulling your weight, then you're out on your ear pretty quick. Yeah. I mean, I like it. I mean, I've been reading that passage every day for 3 weeks, so my fondness for it is fading fast. I saw in New York, Ricky Gervais as part of a New Yorker festival. He spoke about The Office, and he showed clips of The Office and extras, and you know, so many of the jokes just don't, there's nothing, they don't translate about, you know, minor English soap stars and bits of vocabulary and all that kind of thing. I try not to write in a kind of international fashion. I mean, I think if you start writing thinking, will it be understood in New York, will it be understood in Greece, will it be understood in France, then you start writing very bland stuff. But this book was partly set in America, so it's much easier to read in America. But there are sections, like the section where Howard goes to see his father in Cricklewood in England, and they watch Countdown, which means nothing here, for instance, and they have McVitie's biscuits. And so I'm much more likely to read that in England than here. So there are passages which I think are quite defiantly English, but it's fairly American, a lot of the book, one way or another. I don't know, I think planning's overrated. I don't plan that much, but people do it differently. I often tell a story that is true. I went to see Will Self one day in his house, and his study is like wallpapered with post-it notes planning every single page of the book. It's extraordinary. And then at the other end, I once saw the plan for Mrs. Dalloway, which is literally just 6 bullet points, and that's it. That's all she wrote down, and that was the end of the plan. I'm kind of in between. I plan out the first half, and then the second half, I do sort of wing it. I think that the best analogy for it is something like if you were in a jazz band and you all agree what key you're going to play in and maybe what the song is, basically, but then within that you need room for movement and improvisation. That's kind of how I work. I don't know. If my book's going to be turned into a movie, The White Teeth was a TV show. This book... I think it's under consideration, but I don't know anything more about it than that at the moment. I mean, I read all of them, and I don't... I feel very much like they're school reports. It's the same kind of thing, and some of them are good and some of them are bad. And I take them the same way I took school reports. You know, some teachers are just actively mean for the sake of it, but other people are mean, and I was one of those teachers, I think. But other people are mean for a reason, because there's something wrong. So I take them seriously, and I try and adapt myself. But also, I think when I was younger, if someone criticised me, I just immediately changed the thing, and I'm quite like that. I like to please people. And the older I get, I think the more you have to keep something which is you. You know, you can't just let yourself be criticized out of existence. And so there are things about my style that I've just, I'm reconciled to. It doesn't mean I don't want it to be better, but I can't be a different writer. I can only be the writer I am and improve within that remit. I can't transform into a different style. So I think I've stopped trying to do that. That's definitely true.
Yeah, the lady there.
I don't go on TV, and the only TV I've ever done twice is Charlie Rose, because it seems to me like not a TV show in some way. You go in, it's a black room, there's Charlie, can't see any cameras. It just seems like this weird thing I do once every 4 years, go into a room with this guy, and then we talk for an hour, and I never have to see the show, and I've never seen either of the Charlie Roses I've done. So I don't know, but he himself is a charming man and an incredibly hard-working man. It's just extraordinary. Before, I sat in the green room because he was running late, and I watched him interview Elaine Stritch and the famous English geneticist, whose name has just gone by me for a minute, and a woman from High Finance. And, you know, he does have great researchers, but it's still pretty extraordinary. And he looks so kind of awake on screen, and the minute it's over, he's like, oh, he's so tired. He did tell me that he'd done 20,000 interviews in the past 10 years, which is just absolutely mind-boggling. But no, I think he's lovely. I wish all TV was like that, just people in dark rooms and no sets and no gimmicks. Or it's pure TV, if such a thing could exist. That's it.
Yeah.
I think the thing which I draw most on is my family. Not, I mean, this family is quite different from my family because they're kind of upper middle class intellectuals, and my family aren't really that seen at all. But I think there are things which deep patterns which stick in your fiction. I think one of them for me is the idea of a long marriage. It's always in my mind, even though my parents actually had a very short marriage. They divorced a long time ago, but our family unit is still quite tight. I think family is just the model of my brain. I think in families, it would be very hard for me to write a book in which the main action is two people falling in love, for instance. I think that would be very unlikely. Just doesn't really interest me that much for some reason in a narrative sense, but families always does. So I think that's the connection. And even in The Autograph Man, though nobody's blood related, those boys have made a family for themselves. They're friends as family.
Anybody? Yeah.
On tour, my husband and I brought about, you know, 25 books in the kind of way that people who read books do, like you think you always have to have one in your bag or something. And we just posted them back because I can't even get through US Weekly in the back of the limos that they drive you from hotel to hotel. I'm exhausted. I haven't read anything. But before I left, I was reading Hilary Mantel. I read Giving Up the Ghost and Beyond Black, and I'm kind of stuck on the page 30 of Experiment in Love since I've been travelling. I haven't got any further. But she's the first writer in a while that I've wanted to read all of. That doesn't happen very often. I think she's really amazing, so that's what I'm reading at the moment.
Yeah.
I don't listen to music when I'm writing unless it has no words, because I find it quite distracting. But no, my brother supplied a lot of Carl's lyrics because he also is a rapper, and that made it much easier. And in terms of the dialogue of Carl and Levi, I wanted to write a young black man's dialogue, but I had checked with my brothers a lot, and I don't usually do that. I usually just go ahead and I don't care if it's wrong or not. But I didn't. I just felt like I could really embarrass myself in a chronic way. And so my little brother, he had like very strict rules about, you know, don't be saying for sheezy or kneesy or any of that. Don't do that. And don't say anything which, you know, is faddish. Or so in the end, we kind of settled upon a vocabulary which is, I guess, noticeably American, noticeably black, but kind of classic. So words that don't go away, like cool, for obvious words like that. And brother and sister, which are still used all around the world, not just in America. So we were trying, I was thinking of, I mean, a lot of the hip-hop that's quoted are Biggie and Tupac and people that I love, but I wanted it to be not the kind of language which would disappear next week, because that would be a bit of a pain.
Yeah.
Bobby Dazzler is, it's a joke, because my agent, though she's not, she's only 42, uses the language of the First World War all the time, and it just really drives me insane. She comes up with some phrase, like, what, a Bobby Dazzler? A Bobby Dazzler, it just means something wonderful and shiny and brilliant. It must have some original, but God knows, you'd have to go to the OED to find it. But George is just one of these women who has a very strange, dated A&E type vocabulary, really bizarre.
Yeah.
Well, I wrote about it recently. It genuinely was the case that I thought of the story and I was all ready to write it. And I was just describing the story to my husband, and he was like, okay, but, you know, that's a lot like Howard Zinn. And I was like, what? And then he was right, of course. And I hadn't even noticed. So it was kind of like plagiarism by dream, subconscious plagiarism. And then I kind of, I got quite interested in the idea, and also when I started thinking about Howard Zinn, there's a lot of elements of Howard Zinn which are also taken from earlier books. There's bits of Mansfield Park in there, and there are lots of other writers kind of swimming around in that book, and I quite like the idea of that. And once I decided to do it, I guess I thought, well, some people will just turn from it, like the way, I know, people turn from Bridget Jones because it's so much Pride and Prejudice. You can just object, it's fine, there's no reason not to, but I don't object to that, so I thought it was okay, and people who didn't object would enjoy it, and people who did, I guess, wouldn't buy it or whatever. A few more questions, yeah. I was really amazed, actually, because the long list, I don't know how far anybody got in the long list, but, for instance, Hilary Mantel is a writer on the long list, and the quality seemed to me extraordinary, and there were books left off the shortlist which just don't really make sense to me. I don't understand why they weren't on the shortlist, unless the shortlist is just too short and needs to be longer. But I'm really flattered. I mean, I think myself and Ali Smith were both in the same imprint in Hamish Hamilton, and I think we were both like, my God, look at this. It was extraordinary. But I think the good thing is, being on tour, I haven't had time to think about it much, and I get back to London the morning of the prize, so I just got to put some clothes on and go and see what happens. But, yeah, it's really exciting. It's great. One more question, maybe? Will we sign? Yeah. I don't even know who's up for it. You never really know. I mean, I do love Roth, and I think if I was Roth and I'd written all those novels of such quality so frequently, I would think it's time for my Nobel. Wouldn't you? I think that's fair enough. He's done some incredible work, and when you look at the... But then there's also Updike, you know, it's a tough one, but I think it should go to American, or at least it shouldn't not go to American for reasons of politics. Writers shouldn't be responsible for wider issues of that kind. So I would say Updike or Roth, and I don't know if I have a preference there, actually. Okay, I think I'm going to sign, so I'll be right here. Okay. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Audrey Niffenegger, Nicholas Evans, Dan Savage, Clive Barker, Charles Blackstone, Lemony Snicket, Al Franken, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 5th, 2005.